rise around them. Julie McCarthy, NPR News, Islamabad.
One man is dead, two are mauled by a bear at a campground outside Yellowstone National Park in Montana, and a woman appears to have escaped injury by playing dead. Deb Friel of Ontario tells her story to CBS's The Early Show today.
I went totally limp, and as soon as I went limp, I could feel his jaws get loose, and then he let me go, and he went away.
Wildlife officials are trying to capture the bear with baited traps. They say they have enough evidence to make a match. Friel says people in the next campground helped her away after the bear left the area. She says she camps frequently, and this event will not stop her. I'm Paul Brown in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the William and Flora Hewlett Foundation, making grants to solve social and environmental problems at home and around the world on the web at hewlett.org.
I'm Eric Glass, and back in the 1970s, a reporter for the Atlanta Journal did this column called The Georgia Rambler. He basically would get into his car, drive into some small town he'd never been before, and say to the people there, I'm looking for somebody interesting or unusual, somebody who has a good story. Well, this week on This American Life, we try it ourselves. I'm looking for somebody interesting or unusual, has a good story. The Georgia Rambler.
Saturday afternoon at 1 and Sunday evening at 6 on AM 580.
Good morning and welcome to Focus. This is our morning talk show. My name's David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. And we're also pleased to have back on the program once again Brian Johnson. He's head of the Department of Journalism at the U of I, and he teaches courses in multimedia and photojournalism. He's a former staff photographer for the News Gazette newspaper, has been here at the university for a number of years and quite for a long time. He's been here on this program every once in a while. We talk about photography, something that in the time that we have been talking has changed a lot. At least we've gone from the age of film to the digital age. And when we do the programs, we invite folks to call with questions. And maybe you have some photographic task, something that you have in mind you want to try to do, but you're just not sure how to do that. Or you have questions about equipment. Maybe you're going to buy a camera and you're not sure what to look at or what to think about. Or maybe you're just thinking about trying to take better pictures, whatever it is, whether you're taking pictures on vacation or you're taking pictures of your family or, you know, whatever it is that you're trying to capture and you feel that something of, you're just not getting the pictures that you want. Maybe he can give you a little bit of advice. So any and all of that equipment, technique, whatever's on your mind, you can call us, 333-9455. That's the Champaign-Urbana number. Toll-free, 800-222-9455. And you can also send along your questions by email to will-talk@illinois.edu. Thanks very much for being
here.
Sure.
Oh, happy to be here.
Well, you know, I was thinking just a little bit about Anselm Adams, actually, just because it was in the news.
The story about the long, supposed
the
long
allegedly
lost
long lost
glass plates.
Glass plates. Uh-huh. And maybe people have heard that there is a story now that a guy bought some glass plate negatives at a garage sale.
10 years ago.
10 years ago. And he must early on have thought that it was something special.
He did, you know, and I just read yesterday that he'd had them underneath his pool table until, you know, like, you know, fairly, you know, within, I think 4 years ago when he decided he'd really look. But another story said he's been trying to prove for 10 years that what he found was, you know, were Ansel
was
Adams.
Was.
And then I read yesterday that his grandson, Ansel Adams' grandson, who runs Ansel Adams' studio now, said, you know, there's no way you can ever ultimately prove that these were his or not his. But still fascinating.
So there's this big argument. There are apparently some people who have looked at them and said, yes, I think that they are.
Right.
But that the people who are the official guardians of Ansel Adams and his work, they seem to be saying, well, either we're not sure or we don't think that.
Yeah, exactly. You know, one of the things that the grandson said is that they said that some of the notes on the envelopes were written by Ansel Adams' wife. And there are a few misspellings that the grandson said, well, she would have never made those misspellings because they were common place names in the area that she knew so well that she would have never made those mistakes. So It'll be interesting to see.
Well, the thing that I was going to ask you about, and this is a little bit about history of photographic technique. You know, I know what a negative is.
Right. I don't know how many people today, we're going to get to a point nobody knows what negative is, but I know what a negative is, a photographic negative. Now, these are glass plate negatives.
Right. So for many years, photographers, well, in the oldest days, actually, they coated their own glass plates. The reason for it is that the glass was uniformly flat over the whole surface of it. Mm. Fairly durable as far as, you know, except for when you drop it, but as far as handling it and everything. Some of the early film, as we think of it, was actually flammable. And if you've ever looked at the edge of some film, it'll say, for instance, Kodak safety film. That's because they, you know, rearranged the formula of it so it was not flammable. So they would, you know, coat the emulsion on the glass plate and, you know, you'd shoot your picture, you'd, you know, put in the next plate if you wanted to shoot another one. Mm-hmm. Something else that's really key, and this is something that the grandson said that's really right on, that even if they are Ansel Adams negatives, that so much of what Ansel Adams was known for was his printing ability, that the work he did in the darkroom to really, you know, coax out every last bit of tonality and detail from the negatives, that's just as much as his photography. He's known as a master printer. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's something that a lot of people don't probably know or think about it unless they've worked with negatives, but having shot the picture and having the negative is a little bit like having the notes from a meeting. You know, everything's there, but you haven't written the story yet. Mm. And when you're printing, particularly with fine artwork, you can dramatically change the mood and the message of that image based on how you print it and, you know, what you highlight and accentuate and what you toned down. Mm.
So. Well, it's interesting. Last night on All Things Considered, they were talking about this, and they were talking with somebody who was, I believe, was the curator of a great photographic archive where they had lots of photographic material, and they have lots of Adams stuff. And one of the things that he said was that you can actually see there were particular photographs that he took that he continued to print year after year, and that though then when you look at the prints,
right,
they're different.
Right.
They were talking about this particular very iconic image, the one with the church and the moon.
Right.
And, you know,
I was going to say
that one.
Yeah.
And he said that it's interesting, you look at some of his earlier prints of that photograph. Mm-hmm. They're very, the mood and the feeling of the picture,
right,
is very different than the one that this really stark one that we've kind of come to know.
Well, you know, the other thing is that many people know Adams' work through books. And until you've actually seen some of his prints in real life, you don't appreciate what everyone's saying about what a wonderful printer he was. Mm-hmm. You know, there's some wonderful books out there with his work, but really it's, you know, when you see that work and the size of it, he was using, you know, a large size negative. I read stories where he, you know, he'd be working on a print and he would spend, you know, 7 or 8 hours working on the print, you know. The thing about working with negatives in the darkroom is that you put the negative in an enlarger, the light shines through the negative, through a lens which enlarges it, and then projects it on the piece of photographic paper. When you're working with that image, you can lighten areas, you can darken areas, but you only see the image when the enlarger's on. And so the rest of it, it's really in your mind where you have to remember where the parts of the negative are that you might want to lighten and darken. You know, it isn't unusual to draw almost a little, in some ways it can almost look like a topographic map where you draw the outlines of different objects and you put, you know, dodge this area for 10 seconds, you know, burn this area in for 15 seconds. And, you know, if your enlarger wasn't stable and it shifted a little bit, then you might get a little bit of a double image.
you know, that didn't happen all that much. But or you might forget to, you know, burn or dodge a certain area, so you'd process the print and, you know, it wouldn't be exactly as you wanted, or it needs a little bit more yet after you've done it. So it's really quite a process.
So when you look at one of his pictures and you think to yourself, now, is there anything that I can I even approach getting anywhere close to? I mean, what is it about his pictures that that give them such impact?
Well, I think it's, for me, it's the range of tone and detail that really, if you look at certain areas, your eye is almost subconsciously led into the parts of the photograph that the darkroom artist wanted you to focus on. And, you know, negatives produce the image, but yet the ability of the negative to record all the tones and then the ability of the photographic paper to show all those tones when you're printing it, you know, it isn't just slap the negative and print it and go. You've got to, you know, darken certain areas and lighten certain areas. So so I think it's the mastery of being sure that all the detail is there, that, you know, you're sort of leading the person's eye into where it wants to go, but doing it in a way that it doesn't look like anything's been done. So it looks very natural, that, you know, you feel like you're just looking at an image and you almost don't know what's drawing you into a certain part, but it's, you know, the how the photographer dealt with the lightness and darkness of the image. Mm.
Our guest in this hour of focus is Brian Johnson. He's a professor of journalism here at U of I, and occasionally is on the program. We talk about photography, and questions are welcome, either about technique, about hardware. You can give us a call, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. You can also email us at will-talk@illinois.edu, and we have a couple of people here ready to go. The first is in Terre Haute, Indiana, line one. Hello.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. Mm-hmm. I'm interested in getting a scanner to scan old photos, and I have a scanner at home, but I'm not very satisfied with the quality that I'm getting.
Sure.
Do you have a recommendation?
So are you looking to scan mostly old photographs?
Basically old photographs. I also have slides.
Okay. Okay. Yeah, that's what I was wondering. Scanner technology has come a long way so that the prices are fairly low. In fact, even before the show started, I'm at an internet retailer's site. The first thing I clicked on was scanners, because for so many of us, we have either old slides, old negatives, old images. The thing that you want to look for is, one, you want to look at the resolution of the scanner. And you want to look at the native resolution of it, because some scanners advertise resolution, like I'm looking at a Canon scanner here, 4800 by 9600 DPI. But with some manufacturers, what they do is they show you the interpolated resolution. So the scanner itself might really be, you know, like 800 by 800, but it uses the software to kind of figure out how to sort of fake extra resolution. So anyway, so that's, you know, one thing. The other thing is you want to try to determine what the range is of colors that it can resolve. You know, most of the scanners are really excellent with that. So I'm just looking at this particular Canon. It says color 48-bit internal, 48 or 24-bit external, and then grayscale 16-bit and 8-bit. So the higher the bit range for the color depth, the better the image will be. But and here's the big deal, is that, you know, not all software can handle images with these higher, you know, levels. Like Photoshop can handle a 16-bit grayscale image fine, but some of the filters and things won't work unless it's an 8-bit. So I'm going to make this easy. I'm going to go back through all of it. The truth is that most of the scanners do a pretty good job scanning, but it pays to take a little bit of time to experiment with the scan. So take one image that you're working on. And usually the scanner software will have a few settings. So it'll have an automatic tone adjustment. Well, you may or may not like the automatic tone adjustment. Sometimes it's better to, you know, have it use a manual tone adjustment where you scan it and then look at that image and see, you know, how the quality of it looks. So with the scanner that you had that you weren't happy with the results, where was it falling short?
Well, if I tried to print anything out after I'd scanned it, I guess it was the resolution mostly that didn't seem to be so good.
Okay, so would pictures look a little bit fuzzy or?
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
They look fine on the computer screen, but if you try to print anything, they just don't look like the original.
Okay. Yeah, so there's something else tied in with that is that the resolution for the computer screen or the resolution that a computer screen needs to make the image look good is really quite a bit less resolution than a printer needs to print something so that it looks good. So when you're printing, when you're scanning, be sure that you're scanning at a high enough resolution for the printer. So that's why I say, you know, scan one in, see what it looks like. You don't necessarily always need to scan at the highest resolution that the scanner will handle because sometimes it'll scan with such a high resolution that it's more resolution than the printer can even resolve. So I guess that's what I would say. I would experiment. I would look at the settings that the scanner has. You know, sometimes they'll do automatic color enhancement, and sometimes that just makes the colors too contrasting bright. So overall, that's my message. I would experiment with the different settings, you know, all the way through the system from when you scan it to when you print it. And see if you can find sort of a base level setting that looks acceptable to you.
Okay.
Yeah. Go ahead.
I was just going to say thanks for the information.
Okay, sure.
All right, thank you. And it seems to me now that there are a lot of scanners that are coming at around, I don't know, about $200?
Oh, yeah. You know, I'm looking at, you know, some of these right here, $116, $170. You know, kind of a upper-level Canon one just because C comes before, you know, Epson or any of the other ones. You know, they have, you know, CanoScan 9000F. That's only $228, and it'll scan 35mm film, 120 size film, and also, you know, obviously, you know, prints and all that. You know, a lot of them will have auto scan mode. They'll have like a, you know, press the button and send the scan right to the printer mode. So it's basically like a copier, like a color copier almost. But, you know, they're scanning to get a decent scan isn't that hard. You can, you know, do it. But to get something, again, almost not necessarily at Ansel Adams quality, but there's a lot you can do with an image to really improve the way it prints. And it takes a lot of experimentation. You know, even when I'm printing, if I do a bunch of pictures of our incoming grad students, it takes me quite a number of tries before I find the setting I like, the adjustment for that picture and the printer settings before I am satisfied with it and I can go. One other thing I'm going to add in there too is that you also need to calculate in where you're going to be viewing that picture, because if you're viewing the picture under fluorescent light, well, the color of that light will affect what colors can reflect off of that print. Mm-hmm. So if it is going to be a print you're going to put on a wall, you need to think, well, is this mostly going to be illuminated by daylight? Is it going to be an incandescent light? You know, is it fluorescent light, whatever?
All right. Well, I have some other callers here. Let's go to Champagne next, line two. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
In terms of back to Ansel, just briefly here, do you know whether he retouched his negative?
Boy, I don't know that off the top of my head. So that would be something to look up. Do you have a thought about it, or do you know if?
Well, I don't know. I've done black and white, and actually, the tones and stuff are absolutely amazing. You know, I've also developed and did quite a few different things with it. But they were all, I assume, 8x10, right? Because this is what he was known to work with.
Yeah, I mean, yes, a lot of them were the 8x10 size.
The other one is that I do know that he did a lot of preparation, actually, in terms of taking the picture. I mean, he would...
Exactly.
I mean, you know, he'd be out there for a long time, you know.
Right, exactly. You know, he was a proponent of, you know, what came to be known as the zone system. So it dealt with how you would expose the image and then how you would process the image to maximize the tonality of that negative, like you say, you know, even before he got into the darkroom.
Yeah, he was sort of, for everybody back in the day in terms of photography, he was sort of the inspiration, I think, for a lot of people. So.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Great show.
All right, thank you. Over to Belgium, line four. Hello.
Hello, and good morning to you all. To continue on with Mr. Adams just a little bit, over in Indianapolis a few years ago, there was an exhibit of his material at the Eiteljord, and the thing that impressed me the most about it was that almost every one of his prints are very large.
Yes.
And when they're that large and you stand up close to them, you can find amazing detail in it. It's just phenomenal. Everything he covers and looks at is just fabulous prints.
Right. No, I think that's really an excellent point. It gets back to, you know, if you've seen them in a book, it's one thing. But then you're exactly right. I mean, that's a big part of it, is that just the size of the image and the sharpness and the detail just really comes through. I mean, it not to sound corny, but it almost takes your breath away. You know, you look and you're like, wow, now I can see why people have, you know, been talking about Ansel Adams for all these years.
I also noticed that I've been to many of the sites where he took the pictures.
Yes.
Many of the sites. And even though it's changing years, but it's there. You know what I mean? It's just,
right.
It's just like looking at it.
Right.
It's just, well, you don't usually see that in many photographs.
Right, right, which is always kind of an eerie feeling. You know, you're like,
yeah.
Wow, that was, you know, so many years ago, but yet here I am looking at it and I can still see, you know, the forms and some of the rocks are still there in the same spot. So.
Exactly. The question I really wanted to ask you about is, I heard just very recently, and I don't know if this is a fact, I may be altogether wet about this situation, but I had heard that film developing for, you know, film,
right.
The process of developing films has been reduced down to very, very few people, and there's one that's just about to disappear in Kansas. That'll be the last one. Is that like Kodachrome? Or?
Yeah, you know, right. With Kodachrome especially, Kodachrome, the process to get Kodachrome slides from, you know, the raw film to a finished slide was very exacting. There were a few steps in the process where the temperature needed to be within a quarter of a degree, and it was, you know, a multi-step process. So I've been hearing that for years as well, that, you know, that they've really gone down in the numbers of places that would process it.
Yeah, I've heard the last one is still open in Kansas someplace, and it's scheduled to quit doing it this year.
Right. Well, and you can imagine that, you know, how much Kodachrome film is still left out there. There are a lot of people that stocked up. You know, as that dwindles down, yeah, you have to think that it's a pretty expensive process. And if they're not getting enough film to make a go of it.
So I assume then there's no more Kodachrome film, so therefore it doesn't need to be developed anymore?
Well, you know, whatever people have in their freezers, Kodak manufactured it, it looks like, until 2009. So
what happens after that?
Then there'll probably be, I'm going to guess, some artists, some serious amateurs that'll do it just because it's an archaic process and they love, you know, working with it. But at some point it gets to the place where you possibly won't be able to process it in the same old way. You know, if there's a call for it, you know, someone might come out with an alternate process or some way to do it. But
thank you very much, sir.
All right, thank you. Our guest this morning in this hour of focus, Brian Johnson. He is head of the Department of Journalism at the U of I and is a photojournalist, worked for our local newspaper, has been teaching at the U of I for a long time, and also for quite a long time, has been here every once in a while, and we talk about cameras and photography and questions. Welcome.
Yeah, and in fact, I'm looking at Dwayne's photo. Dwayne's photo is not closing.
Good news.
We will continue to process other types of film and provide our normal service in 2011. Only Kodachrome film processing is being discontinued. So it says here, the last day of processing at Dwayne's photo, a trusted name in photo processing for over 50 years, it says, will be December 30th.
And where is Dwayne's photo?
That is something I will find out about us. Welcome. Contact us is where I'll go. Yeah, Parsons, Kansas.
Kansas.
Yeah.
So again, so they're saying that they're still going to do some developing, but they're saying the Kodachrome, you're out of luck. We're not doing that anymore.
December 30th, 2010.
The end of this
yeah.
year. So if you have pictures.
If you have pictures or if you have the film, you want to use it, use it and, get it to Dwayne.
See Dwayne. All right. Other questions, welcome. 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. Email will-talk@illinois.edu. We have a caller next in Normal, line one. Hello.
Yes. I have a Canon PowerShot little digital camera I purchased. And I've used it for taking pictures, and I've used it for taking a little bit of video. And when I take the video, it seems to work fine, and I can watch it on the camera. And then when I upload it to the computer, it looks like there are skips sometimes. Not like I
Sure.
will the camera, but just skips. And I'm wondering if there's some setting on the camera I should be looking into, or if it's just that my computer is not totally up to date. I mean, I can usually watch video on the web just fine, but...
Right, exactly. Well, what I'm going to guess is what's happening. Either one of two things... Both sort of related. Either the hard drive on your computer isn't able to keep up with the data rate, so it's showing you the video from the hard drive, but then the video gets further along and it says, come on, give me some more data, and the hard drive's saying, okay, come on, I'm looking for it. So what it'll do is it'll skip a frame or two. When that happens, sometimes it'll be the computer's processor that can't keep up. Almost all of the cameras really are using some form of compression when it's shooting video, and it's called a codec. It means compression, decompression. Well, it's the decompression part where it says, okay, I've got this image that's squished together. I need to expand it when I play it back, and sometimes the computing power needed to do that decompression part is a little bit more than the computer can handle. If you were to take that file and burn it onto a DVD and then, put it in your DVD player and watch it on your TV set from the DVD player, I'm going to guess that it would be 100% fine.
So I wouldn't have to upload it again to a new computer to do that.
Right.
I can get it from the file that's already uploaded. It's in there. Correctly, it's just the displaying of it is the problem.
Right. Usually that's exactly what it is. And especially from the cameras where it's digital, it's not recorded on tape or anything. So when it went from the camera to the computer, it just went as a file. Video takes a fair amount of processing and hard drive speed to make it play smoothly. Yeah. So I would bet that it is fine. You don't need to upload it again. But if you want to watch it on the computer, yeah, you might need to get either a faster hard drive or a faster computer.
Okay, thanks so much.
Great.
All right, very good. Thank you. Well, again, other questions, welcome. You give us a call, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455, and email will-talk@illinois.edu. I want to go just back for a second to, we were talking earlier with somebody about a scanner. And I was thinking, I would guess now all computers come with some kind of photo processing software in them, or maybe most of them do.
I think that that's true. And if it doesn't, there are either low cost or free software programs that you can use. Adobe even has an online version of Photoshop. That's pretty inexpensive. Macs always come with iPhoto that you can use for that.
So, but I was just wondering about just for the basic stuff, the least expensive or the free stuff.
Right.
How much, what sort of limitations that has. And if, for, say, for example, you go out and you get a pretty good scanner, but your processing software on the computer is maybe not all that good. And is it could be that the scanner will give the computer more information than the computer knows what to do with.
Right, or, right. You know, lots of the lower-end photo adjustment software, some of them don't have professional features like working with those higher bit images, the higher color depth images. And, you know, that's why I was telling that other caller that even though your scanner might be able to scan at this really high resolution, you might not need that much resolution for the print you're trying to make. But here's the kicker with that is that you don't know how you might want to use that image in the future. You might say, you know, look at that. There's Cousin Benny, and it's the only picture of Cousin Benny with his military uniform on. So you might want to enlarge just a really small portion of that picture. So I think always scanning at the highest resolution makes sense, but then knowing that you can downsize things if you need to. Okay. Getting back to your question, though, you know, digital cameras today produce such a great quality image that not as much processing is needed to get a decent kind of straightforward print. So, and, you know, a lot of the printers are pretty good, too. So that's the beauty of it is that you're not necessarily required to do a lot of that. Some of the cameras have processing within the camera where if they're really bright areas, really dark areas, it will, you know, sort of level them off within the camera even.
Yeah. I was just thinking about some things I have read lately suggesting that, you know, maybe at one point people would have said a software like Photoshop would be way more complicated and would do way more than probably most people would want to deal with.
It's but mind-boggling.
At the same time, I get this impression that because there are more and more people that are comfortable doing stuff with computers and that they're interested in tweaking photos, particularly according to a recent interesting piece that was in the New York Times, particularly pictures they've taken of themselves.
Oh, yeah.
They want to make it look as good as they possibly can.
Sure.
So that actually people are well, yeah, or what,
for me.
Smoother, you know, yeah. Smooth out the wrinkles. That actually more people are actually making more use of fairly sophisticated
right. And,
software.
You know, a lot of those retouching components or those retouching tools are built in even to a lot of the lowest end software because they know that that's what people want to do. And, in fact, that's what professional photographic portraits have had done to them for years and years. They've basically always been retouched. The earlier caller had asked if Ansel Adams retouched his negatives. Well, a lot of professionals would shoot with a larger size negative so you could retouch the image right on the negative so that when you made prints, you didn't have to basically paint each individual print. You could just, you know, get it from the negative. So, yeah, so, I mean, all professional portraits, I think, to some degree have been retouched forever. And so now, you're right, yeah, people can do it on their own, you know, taking out blemishes or, you know, smoothing out the skin, things like that.
Yeah. It seems like that more what's happening is that more people are, because they're doing social media,
right.
and which they are including pictures of themselves,
uh-huh.
Well, this is part of the deal of, you know, trying to present yourself in either in the best possible way or just the way that you want to
right.
you want it to be.
Right.
And that there are a lot of things that you can do to alter the image that maybe in the past only pros would have been
right.
doing.
Right, right. Some of it's kind of fun to do, too. I mean, you know, when I'm working with family images, there's a family reunion picture that I shot 3 years ago. And, you know, for me, so I'm coming from the photojournalist realm, you know, for my own kind of artistic work, I won't touch it. But for this case, it was a family picture. And, you know, I shot like, you know, 15 different frames of these 30 people all together. And I, you know what? I mean, I wanted everyone to look good. And yeah. So I was taking, you know, faces from other images and putting it on the one master image. I mean, there were probably, 15 heads that I replaced or adjusted. Really? Since I was taking the picture, I wasn't in it. So then I had my brother-in-law take a picture of me in the same spot as everyone else, and I digitally
and you put yourself and
put myself
into the photo.
In. Yeah, again, you know, for these family portraits, mm-hmm. Because of how they're used, I wasn't changing any features of anyone. I was just being sure that people looked. I chose the image where they looked the best and put it in.
You don't want your family photos to look like Diane Arbus took them.
Yeah, that'd look a little bit harsh and freakish.
Yeah, probably. Exactly. All right, let's go to Normal, line 4. Hello.
Hello?
Yes.
Hello.
Okay. Yeah, I was lucky enough to get a free camera body from a friend who decided to upgrade and then said, I don't know why I did that. It was a wonderful camera. It's a Nikon D70S.
Uh-huh.
And so all I have to do, but all is in quotes, is add a lens. But, of course, that's the most expensive part.
It can be the most expensive part. Yes. I mean, it's something that a lot of people don't think about. They think, oh, I've got this camera. And for many people, it's the camera and the lens together. So you do have the lens. But, starting out with a good camera is a good deal. So.
Yeah. So I have a couple of questions. One is, do you think that the D70S is probably 3 years old now? Do you think that's worth working with and staying with and building a camera around?
You know, if the camera's in good shape yet, I would say sure. I think it would be, totally fine.
Yeah.
You know, it's I'm just looking at some information here. So it's a 6-megapixel camera. We haven't, talked about this yet today, but one of the things that David and I have talked about in the past is it's not just the megapixel rating, but the size of the chip itself. Mm-hmm. And so I'm looking here at the specifications for this. And while it's a 6-megapixel camera, it does have a fairly large chip in it. It's, 23.7 by 15.6 millimeters, which makes it a fairly large chip. What that means is that even though it's, quote, only 6 megapixels, it's still going to give you a better image than, some of the smaller cameras that might even be, higher in the megapixel
range. Well, and it's my understanding that you don't need more than, 99.9% of people wouldn't need more than 6. That's plenty for anything I would want.
Right.
I mean, I'm not going to,
And one of the advantages, since this camera has interchangeable lenses.
Right.
So the reason that some people would need, more larger megapixel range is if they wanted to crop into the image really tightly. But what you can do is you can, when you're shooting the image, you can, zoom in on it, maybe put on a different lens that, can get in closer. So,
okay. Well, that goes into the other part of my question, which is the lens itself. I really do most of my shooting when I travel.
Uh-huh.
And I really don't want several lenses. I know that I'm not going to bother with that. So a couple of people have told me that a 18-200 is, the best all around. You sacrifice a little bit of quality, and I don't know quite what that means, but that it's really great. I don't know if I really need up to 200 myself or not.
Yeah, I'm always wishing with my little point-and-shoot camera that I had that I could zoom in closer.
Yeah.
So even though it, like you say, it seems like, do I really need, to get in as close as a 200-millimeter lens would give me,
You find yourself using it.
You find yourself using it, yeah, absolutely.
Okay, so you think that the 18-200 is a great idea?
I actually do. That's a phenomenal range.
I know.
I would, as much as you're able, I would try to buy the best quality lens that you could get. So I'd probably...
with a Nikon?
Yeah, I'd stick with a Nikon lens.
I know there's a cheaper one by a couple hundred dollars, and my husband kind of said, don't. get the best.
Right, exactly, because here's been my philosophy over, my entire photographic life, is that if there's going to be a problem with an image, I wanted it to be my fault and not the fault of my equipment.
Yeah.
Because I can learn, but my equipment, if it's subpar or not quite as good as it could be, it's always going to be that way. Mm-hmm. Now, having said that, there are some, you know, some of the third-party manufacturers of lenses do, you know, really make some excellent lenses. So you can go online and, you know, there are reviews of some of the different lenses, too, so you can get a sense of, you know, what's out there. But
yeah, I found one that a lot of, you know, a lot of people said it was great, and then a couple of people said it was horrible and they had a bad time with it. So I'm sure the very safest thing is to go, you know, with the Nikon, I assume.
Yeah, yeah, it is, you know, but on the, you know, downside, be prepared to spend more money.
I know, it's really expensive.
So,
what about going secondhand online? Do you not recommend that?
You know, boy, it's a
crapshoot.
Yeah, it's really tough. You know, if it's someone who either you know that you feel like you can trust, or if it's, you know, one of the natural places that has a guarantee where you can send it back. Yeah, it is just kind of a crapshoot. You don't know if it's going to be, you know, a really great deal or not. I sort of go back and forth depending upon how brave I'm feeling at any time. So.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you very much.
Sure.
Yeah, thanks.
Okay.
We have another caller. We get right to. Just let me introduce again guest, Brian Johnson. He is head of the Department of Journalism here at U of I and teaches photojournalism and has been a photographer for a long time. And occasionally on the program, he is here. We talk about cameras and photography. Your questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free. 800-222-9455. Email will-talk@illinois.edu. And up next is someone here in Champaign County, where we are, line one. Hello.
Hi, I had a question about the rather spectacular refractive event we had last night over the skies. I don't know if people saw the double rainbow. It was the most intense, brightest one I've ever seen.
Really? Awesome.
It was just awesome.
I'm sorry I missed it, actually.
There were a lot of people shooting out in the park, and I just wanted to know if you could say anything, if there's any body of knowledge about shooting a thing like that, with maybe even from a snapshot. I did
sure.
a sort of video sweep of it because I had to shoot, like, really three images with my point-and-shooter to actually get it all.
Yeah, to capture
all the way across the horizon.
Sure.
And, so anything on that, but while you were talking about this woman who is wanting to rehabilitate an older camera body, are there people that are actually changing out the charge coupled device,
you know,
in the back of a body of a camera?
Yeah, you know, Leica had a digital camera where they, along with the camera, they offered where you as new sensors became available.
Upgraded.
Yeah, you could send it back to them and they would upgrade it. And I believe that they would do it for free as part of the purchase price. But again, when you're buying a Leica, you're spending, you know, multiple thousands of dollars to begin with.
Right, but as far as just the typical...
Yeah, you know, and I think, you know, what most people are doing is they're just getting, you know, I think that's how this, how the former caller got the camera body that she did, is that someone upgraded and they just got a whole new camera body. And the advantage of that is that there's a lot with the metering system and the
right,
way it's processing
right.
it. Yeah. So,
okay. Thanks very much. For
yeah.
That one.
Sure.
And anything about shooting a rainbow.
Yeah, sure. Yeah. So with rainbows, one thing that I always try to do is I'm very careful with my exposures. And I find myself tending to want to shoot an image that's a little bit deeper in tones. So there are a couple ways to do that. Some cameras have an exposure compensation setting. So on my camera, there's a little plus and a minus button, basically. I press that, and I can dial it either to minus, like minus one-third, minus two-thirds, minus one, or plus. So if I go to the minus side, it makes my image deeper. And if I go to the plus side, it makes it lighter. A lot of times with the sky, it's depending upon where the exposure sensor is pointed, that can dramatically affect how the sky is recorded. So if I have an exposure compensation And if my images are coming washed out a little bit, which usually with the sky is what will happen, what I'll do is I'll put the exposure to, you know, minus two-thirds possibly and see what that looks like. If your camera doesn't have an exposure compensation or if you don't have the time to mess with it, with many cameras, if you press the shutter button halfway down, it will lock in the exposure and focus settings wherever it's pointed at that point. So what I'll do is I'll point the camera at a brighter part of the sky, press the shutter button halfway, and then I'll keep that button pressed halfway down and then move the camera over and recompose with, you know, the rainbow or whatever it is I'm trying to shoot. So that's a way you can kind of manually control the camera even though it's in an automatic setting.
So that's something that I think probably a lot of people who aren't really that into photography maybe don't think about. That is, if you have a camera and it's going to set the exposure automatically.
Right.
The question is, and you're looking at a scene, so you're looking at what the camera sees, or even with your eye, you're looking at what you see. Well, what you're seeing, there are darker areas and then there are lighter areas.
Right.
And the question is, as the camera is looking at this, it's trying to figure out how to set the exposure. So what is it going to look at to
right.
make the decision?
Right. And that's, you know, that's one of the things, one of the aspects of newer cameras that's been so great is that they are able to look at the entire scene many times and say, well, we've got this really bright spot over here. We have this really dark spot over here. And then it looks in its little database of exposure settings and it says, this seems like someone is trying to take a landscape with a bright sky. And so it says the camera to itself, well, if that's the case, then you're going to expose it this way. Some of the cameras also then will say, well, if I just kind of use this one exposure over the whole sensor, it's going to leave this part too bright. So some of the cameras are smart enough to kind of adjust that contrast or that tonality within itself. Something that we haven't talked about at all, some of the higher-end cameras will allow you to shoot in what's called the RAW mode. And what the RAW mode does is it records everything that the sensor captures. Because otherwise what happens, if you think about the sensor, it can record a broad range of tones. And the cameras set a white balance. And it says, oh, we're indoors under incandescent light. So it records just the tones from the sensor that make it a correct looking image just within that incandescent light range. But the sensor itself actually did have more tones that it could record. Mm-hmm. Well, in the RAW mode, it records that full range of tones so that when you are on the computer later, you can decide, well, here's my full range of tones. Where do I want the color balance to be?
Yeah.
So that gives you a little bit of extra flexibility as well.
Well, and that's, you wonder if you're going to try to do some working with image and you got pretty good software, then are you really going to want to shoot in the RAW mode all the time?
Right.
Well, maybe not all the time.
Well, but, you know, I mean, honestly, I pretty much shoot in the RAW mode all the time, and a lot of professionals, you know, shoot in the RAW mode. It takes more memory on your memory card to do that, but the flexibility that it gives you later, that adjustment ability, you know, particularly because many times you're shooting and the scene is what it is, the amount of time you have to shoot is what it is, and, you know, so you shoot that image, and, you know, if you're in the RAW mode, at least you'll have the greatest capacity to adjust it later.
Yeah. Well, that brings up another point, though, that with camera, with a lot of cameras, you can choose the amount of information that's going to go into every picture. And you might say, well, now on some pictures, maybe I don't need to have it as sharp and detailed. And you might also think, well, that's also good because then that means I can take
right.
more pictures and I can hold on to them. But also that in your, there's a trade-off here that
yeah,
you're making.
Don't do it is what I'm saying. You know, there have been so many times where students have come in with their own cameras and they're thinking exactly what you're talking about. It's like, oh, you know, if I record at this lower resolution setting, I can record, you know, 10,000 images.
Gajillion pictures, yeah. Right.
And then, you know, what happens, though, is they get back and they're like, okay, great, look at these pictures. And it's like, wonderful, but you can only make a 3-inch by 5-inch print from that. So that's been a wonderful thing that's happened as over the multiple years that you and I have been talking, is that memory cards are now, you know, they've gotten cheaper and cheaper and cheaper, so that at this point, you really want to get an 8-gigabyte card, a 16-gigabyte card. Some of the older cameras don't know how to deal with those larger storage cards. Some of them can only deal with card up to 2 gigabytes. Mm-hmm. But anything that's been made within the past, I don't know, 3 to 5 years can handle those bigger cards. So I always record in the highest resolution that I can. Mm-hmm. And, you know, not all cameras have the RAW mode, but if it does have the RAW mode, I use that.
Yeah. And that also just raises this question that now it's easy to amass a huge archive of images. So then, though, the question is, all right, if you really want to keep that stuff, what are some of your best options for storage? Do you want to try to do that yourself? Do you want to use now one of the online services that will store the material for you? Do you want to, if you really want to make sure you have those images, do you actually want to do both those things to make sure you have as much backup as you can?
Right. You know, I've not been a big fan of the store your photos on our website, wherever it is. Mm-hmm. I like to have all my images locally. You know, I just bought a 1.5 terabyte drive, which, you know, if we listen to this show 10 years from now, we'll laugh. Only one and a half terabytes. But right now, that's an astounding amount of storage. Yeah. I paid $119 for it. And so I, you know, put a new hard drive in the computer at home. It also means that for the drive I use to back up my data, which is a really crucial point, you know, you have to be sure that can hold, you know, that large amount of data. But, yeah, shooting in the highest resolution that you can, you know, just getting a new hard drive and, you know, migrating things forward and then having some form of backup is really crucial.
We'll try real quick to get in one more caller here. Champagne, line one, go ahead.
Yes, good morning.
Yes.
I was wondering for close-up photography, like macro but on a micro budget, so
right,
to speak, do you try to use the largest file size of the camera? Like if you've got a 12 meg, use that one rather than 8 or 5 or lower selection that's available?
Yeah,
sure, exactly. That's a really good question. Yes, if you shoot at the higher resolution, you can crop into it and get that detail that even if you don't have a macro setting per se, you can crop into the image and get that detail. A lot of the cameras do have that close-up setting, though, and they can get literally within millimeters of the subject. So that's another easy way to get those close-ups.
All right, there we got to go. Brian Johnson, head of the Department of Journalism at the U of I. He's a photojournalist for a long time. So been with us to talk about photography. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from these business partners: Birchtree Counseling and Consulting, Champaign; Cannon Farm, Camargo; Carpet Weavers, Champaign; and Dick's Pharmacy, Arthur. These business partners join the friends of WILL in making great programs possible. Thank you.
And we'll break for an update on the markets. We'll be back. Stay tuned.
Agricultural programs are made possible by First Midwest Bank, serving Illinois' agricultural community with locations in Champaign, Danville, Galesburg, Morris, and Moline. More information is available from Bob Baisdiffer in Danville at 217-477-6016. First Midwest Bank, member FDIC, an equal housing lender.
At a minute before 11 o'clock with this market update, I'm Tom Rogers. The commodities are still up this afternoon, or as late this morning at midday, thanks mainly in part to a big increase in wheat, which has hit a 13-month high. September wheat in Kansas City is up 13 cents a bushel at 643 and 3 quarters. December, 660 and a half, up 12 and 3 quarters. September wheat in Chicago is up 7 and a quarter cents at 622 and 3 quarters. D's wheat, 7 and a quarter cents up at 654 and a quarter. Corn for September is at 380¾, up 4.5 cents. December corn, 395, up 4¼. March at 408¼, up 4¾. Crude oil for September up $1.10 a barrel at 78.08. In the soybeans, August was at 10.19¾ cents, up 9¼. September, 9.90¾, up 5¾. And the November, up 7¼ at 9.85¼. August soybean meal at 304.10, up 2.40. Soybean oil for August at 39.07, up 23. In the livestock, August live cattle at